Good morning, you're on Radio National. I'm Richard Ady. Welcome to Life Matters. On today's show, we're posing a very big question. Has feminism failed? And you're in for a real treat, as it's to be debated by an all-star lineup. So no talk back, keep your powder dry for when it returns next week. This Intelligence Squared debate was recorded recently at the Melbourne Town Hall, and the topic is timely, with contentious issues like honour killings, women on boards, sexual harassment at work, and abortion rights in the news every day. Let's hear now from the first two speakers. For the Affirmative, journalist, author, and Canberra ABC TV news presenter Virginia Hausiger. She'll be followed, arguing against the statement, by Jennifer Byrne, also an experienced journalist and currently on our screens as the presenter of the First Tuesday Book Club on the ABC. So let's begin with Virginia Hausiger, who has a sobering update of what life is like for many women. So be aware, there's some challenging content coming up.
Feminism has failed. Now, I know I'm supposed to crack a few jokes, and I'm not a humourless feminist, but I don't have a lot of time. I won't be cracking jokes. There's too much at stake. Feminism is an unnatural, artificial, and abnormal product of modern-day disintegration, which is the inevitable result of the rejection of all moral and spiritual values. But wait, there's more. In the West, women have been reduced to a plaything of enjoyment and fancy. They have degraded themselves and become objects of exploitation by men. They have neither gained liberty nor achieved equality. Rather, they have lost their natural place in the home. The outcome has been horrendous for social peace and stability. The first quote is by Mufti Allah Haran Sheikh from his 2008 book on morality. The second by Islamic scholar Gulham Safar, 2000. There is a totalising ideology on the march across the world, and it is anti-women. This is not about religion. This is about a global war against women. It's about rights and freedoms of women. The chief battleground is a woman's body. Who owns it? Who controls it? Who covers it? And who hides it? Right now, feminism is failing to mount a response to this attack. 2 days ago, a young Palestinian man told the ABC how he smashed his sister's head against the wall, smashed and smashed until he killed her. Khalid Mahmoud explained this wasn't murder, it was an honour killing. His sister had shamed the family by sleeping with a man of her choice. She had to be obliterated for the family's honour to be restored and for Khalid to save face. The police agreed. It wasn't a crime. He wasn't charged. He remains a free man. In some parts of the world, not only do men, fathers, brothers and husbands, own a woman's body, they own her virtue. Their identity and manliness is embedded in it. That is an impossible burden for any woman to carry. For the tens of thousands killed or maimed each year, like teenager Ashia, who last year was held down by her Afghan husband as he cut off her nose and her ears because she tried to escape his family's abuse. And for the hundreds of thousands of women who are savagely punished for expressing their free will, honour doesn't come into it. When 29-year-old Bangladeshi woman Fazilatan Neza came to Australia last year, she could hardly wipe the smile off her face. She kept telling me she was so, so happy to be here. But detecting her smile was a little tricky from certain angles, as her skin is wiped across her face. When Fazilatan was 17, a man threw acid at her because she refused his marriage proposal. Now she travels the world campaigning for the rights of acid victims who are shamed by their families for bringing the family shame. World events and the rise of neo-fundamentalism by young men eager to revive and restore old practices have made feminism more important now than ever. And yet, in the face of this, feminism has lost its voice and therefore much of its power. We just don't know how to respond to the horrors of infallible patriarchal control, or the abuse and degradation paid out on women. This is a moral crisis for feminism. Has feminism failed? No, I wouldn't argue that. I can't argue that. Numbers have improved, legal structures and new frameworks have been erected. The scaffolding is there for some. That scaffolding is precariously shaky. Feminism hasn't failed, but it is failing, and it's on the brink of failure. Right now, at a time in history when we need a massive feminist surge to fight back rising anti-woman sentiment, we're sitting on our hands, unable to respond. Instead, we're bogged down in self-righteousness and trivial discussions about who's a faux feminist. When Monica Dux targeted me in her book as a saboteur of feminism and an imposter, it sounded like I was being pushed out of club feminism by the snooty head girl with the key. But look, what wasn't funny, and in fact what astounded me, was that the other journalist that Dux trashed was the late Pamela Bohn from The Age. With naive flippancy, Dux dismissed Bohn's large body of courageous work because, and I quote, "Later in her career, she started noisily blaming her feminist sisters for ignoring the plight of Muslim women." Why do feminist responsibilities stop at the border? Somali-born feminist Ayaan Hisiali speaks of the West's misguided politeness in opting to say nothing and do nothing about the abhorrent abuses and treatment of women and girls that are excused as cultural custom or religious rites. Honour killings, female genital mutilation, acid attacks, forced marriages, child marriages, and sexual slavery are among the so-called cultural practices she has in mind when Hisiali calls on Western feminists to take on the plight of Muslim women and make it their own cause. Debasement and abuse and the practice of gender apartheid extend beyond fundamentalism and religion. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf says, and I quote, "In its numbers and scale, the systematic discrimination against women outstrips even the wholesale abuses of the 18th and 19th century slave trade. 62 million primary school age girls around the world don't go to school. 520 million women around the world can't read. Ignorance, of course, is a tool of control. It is inconceivable to me that someone can watch a mother give birth, pick up the baby, see that it's a girl, and in disgust throw it into the slops pail to die while uttering the words, useless thing." Chinese writer Xinran Xu described this very scene recently when writing about the gendercide and the world's missing 100 million baby girls. I guess at least being chucked in the bin is quick. Other baby girls are slowly starved or simply abandoned for one single reason: they are female. What is it about girls and women that make them so utterly dispensable? In our own backyard, the Pacific region, some of the rates of maternal death are among the worst in the world. 60% of the Pacific nations around us have no laws against domestic violence, which is perhaps why 73% of the women in the Solomons think it's okay for a husband to beat his wife. Recently, Vanuatu's traditional chiefs challenged a 2008 law passed to protect women from domestic violence, saying it contradicted Vanuatu's custom. Traditional cultural practices that assert male authority will always disadvantage women. So why do we kowtow to them? Why are we so ready to adopt a lazy, cultural relativist position when it comes to blatant discrimination against women? So, has feminism failed? Perhaps not for us. Not for you and me, Monica. But you know what? It's not just about us. Thank you.
Well, tempting as it is to follow Virginia in her global to local Melbourne spat between feminist sisters voyage, a mighty stretch of distance she's covered there, I would like to stick actually to the topic which I would suggest affects us here, which is to argue not just against the proposition that feminism has failed, because my desire and my conviction is to argue something far more positive, which is that feminism as I know it has done a lot more than not failed. Rather, it has succeeded so powerfully and changed things for women so fundamentally that we are now really in that comfortable position of scarcely even noticing it anymore. Because the achievements of feminism, I think, have spun themselves into the fabric of our lives. What we do notice, and let's concede this straight up, I mean, is that the reality can fall short of the dream, or to put it a homelier way, because feminism really is a practical, everyday thing. It's not some great conspiracy, it's how we live. When the shoe pinches sometimes, and it hurts. And this, I suspect, is what my opponents will continue to dwell on tonight. I mean, the bits that went wrong, or that went too far, or where things benefiting the majority, but they've caused discomfort, maybe even distress, and that's obviously disturbing to the minority. But this tends to happen in a lively, active democracy. The deeper truth, I would argue, is that we have, as a society, moved a long way in the past 40 years or so towards acceptance of the central feminist principle, which is not so very radical a principle, which is that we should have economic, social, and political equality of opportunity between the sexes. There you go. There's the bogey. I don't think so. But I do think that we have moved there because I was around. I want to take a personal view, a working girl's view, and look at what feminism has done for me, and I hope for you, and remind you a bit of what it was like before, not in some horrible carping way, and we should be grateful for what the feminists did, not at all. But I do think it's important to remember that one of the biggest complaints made today about feminism is that we have so much choice. Well, I would suggest to you that this is a dilemma that our mothers and our grandmothers might have wished they had a chance to face. It's a particular pleasure for me to come here tonight in this hall, because it's true, I was 16 and when I first came here at the very start of my journalism career, a long time ago. But it was relevant because it was here for the first time that I had a whisper of what this thing that we're debating tonight, feminism, could or might be. The event was the launch of the It's Time campaign by long ago Labour leader Gough Whitlam, who was standing right there. But what I remember most clearly about that night wasn't the slogan, but his speech, which he opened by addressing not the comrades, not the more familiar ladies and gentlemen, but he stood here and he addressed the men and women of Australia. Now, he wasn't the first one to use the phrase, I accept that, but it was the first time I'd heard it. And I was a green girl. I'd just come from years locked up in an all-girls boarding school in the country where it won't surprise you, given the time and place, neither the concept nor the word feminism were ever used. I mean, we knew about Marianne Faithfull and we quite liked Joni Mitchell, but Betty Friedan, Germaine Greer, nah, never heard of them. We didn't know much about politics either, except there was this sort of smallish prime minister, we'd heard about that. His name was William McMahon, and what he did was he bought this thigh-high split dress that he gave to his wife so that she could walk up the steps of the White House and everyone could ogle her, which we thought in the boarding house was a pretty cool thing. She looked spectacular, and he needed the publicity. And now, here was this white-haired giant accompanied by a very outspoken brown-haired giant, and they were talking to me. I was one of the women of Australia. I was an equal, and it was an electrifying thought. And something went whoosh in my head, which was my own little wind of change, I guess, and the possibility, the thrilling possibility occurred to me for the first time that things didn't have to be as they'd always been. And this, for me, is the core argument for feminism and where I would say it has succeeded most spectacularly, which is in the mind. It's a big thing. And for this working girl, it became a guiding principle that I deserved and I was entitled to the same opportunities as my male colleagues. And not just that I would get equal pay, important as that was, but the most important thing was to realise the time was coming when I would not be blocked, that I would get an open chance alongside men, and this wasn't the world I had known. I mentioned mothers and grandmothers before. Well, let me tell you about a conversation I had just a little while back with my mother. She grew up in Britain. She was the only daughter of a military man who went on to become commander of the Royal Marines. So you think he'd have been pretty proud when she was in year 10. Someone said, if you work hard enough, because you're a bright girl, you might get to Oxford one day. She was pretty chuffed. And she told her father, a good man, but a man of his times. And his reaction was, that won't happen. No man will want a wife like that. He took her out of school the following year and sent her to a finishing school where she was taught to sew and to type and to make perfect hospital corners. And the saddest thing when she told me this recently, I felt, wasn't it just that it happened, is that she wasn't even angry. She wasn't even upset. It was unfortunate, but that was the way things were. And I accept this is a class as well as a gender story, but it's what I saw growing up. And they weren't all frustrated, bitter women. I'm not suggesting that. Some people were very happy to be wives and mothers. It was perfect for them. But it was just they didn't get the choice. Flash forward to the working world I entered. I mean, even then, air hostesses were still grounded when they married. Women weren't allowed to fly planes. They weren't allowed to drive trams. And one of the reasons being, seriously, because at certain times of the month, we were deemed unstable. Do you remember that? In my own industry, a female presenter sort of simply disappeared like that off the screen by 40 because they weren't there to work. It was there for eye candy. But what I would say is that feminism made my career possible. I'm grateful for that. It's very easy to pick out these extreme cases, but I've been to those places where the women for honour killings are struggling back from health. The best chance they have is a feminist lawyer. I won't go through the details, but Ayaan Hirsi Ali also said that the liberation of women is a big, giant house, and we in the West, she called for our help. That's a choice we can make. But I think that the really most constructive thing is to stop the opponent's view, stop cutting, dicing, over-defining and minimising what has been achieved in the name of feminism and its spirit. And I really do hope that in your heart you feel feminism has changed your lives for the better. And for the sake of all that's positive, that you will vote for the negative and agree with us that feminism has not failed. Thank you.
Jennifer Byrne, the first speaker for the negative at the recent Melbourne Intelligence Square debate, asking, has feminism failed? A reminder, we're not taking your calls today, but I'd love to get your comments on what we've been hearing. As always, go to the website abc.net.au/rn/lifematters, or you can call the listener line on 02833 1430. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Richard Adie. Now to a feminist, perhaps, but not a woman. Stephen Mayne is the second speaker for the affirmative. The topic, again, is has feminism failed? Stephen is another journalist and shareholder activist. After Stephen, you'll hear the arguments against the statement from the writer and feminist Monica Dux. But first, here's Stephen Mayne speaking after Jennifer Byrne.
Thanks, Jennifer. Well, it's all very well to be able to drive a tram, but women aren't exactly running the corporate world, are they? I mean, think about it. I'm in a debate tomorrow at the casino where they're complaining that business is taking over footy. And they're right. Business is totally taking over footy. Business runs everything. Corporate interests dominate globally. Look at the way the big mining interests were able to roll Kevin Rudd and change a big resources tax proposal. Business rule the world, and who runs business? Blokes. It's all very well to have women getting, 55% of graduates from the law firms and the accounting firms, but there are only 10% of partners, only 3% of managing partners. I mean, I can't believe that the big five headhunters in Australia, the big five international firms, the Egon Zenders of the world, who place people into these top jobs have never had a female CEO in Australia for the last 40 years since they've been in operation. Now, I only came to this Women on Boards issue when I was sitting at the David Jones annual meeting last year on November 30. And I had been to 350 annual meetings as a shareholder activist at that point, and I had never once raised the issue of women on boards. The feminists had never once come to me and said, "This is a shocker, you should get onto it." And I sat there and an old lady got up and said, "It'd be nice to have more women on the David Jones board." And Katie Lay, the only woman on the David Jones board, had been there for 15 years, made a comment that it was a little bit disappointing that women only represented 8.3% of major public company boards in Australia, and it would be better if maybe we were like Norway and we were at 40% through a quota system. And I was sitting back and I suddenly thought, that's unbelievable. So I got up and this is what I said. I said, "Mr. Chairman, I'd like to support the re-election of Katie Lay to the board, but simply have a dip at all you other blokes on the board and point out that it is a disgrace that women only represent 8% of directors of Australian major company boards, and if there is one company in the top 50 that should have a solid population of females on its board, it is this one. A clear majority of your employees are female, a clear majority of your customers are female, and you sit here with a typical board, the banker, the lawyer, the accountant. I can't believe that this board hasn't actually got this issue right." Now, the bloke chairman, Bob Savage, with a smiling Mark McInnes sitting next to him, said, "Oh, look, we've got this covered and, you know, we're a really well-run company and everything's absolutely terrific." 3 months later, they appointed a second director, Philippa Stone, a corporate lawyer. 3 months after that, Mark McInnes was marched out the door with $2 million. And today, two McInnes proteges, CEO Paul Zara and CFO Stephen Goddard, announced that profits were up 9% to $171 million, that there'd been no noticeable drop in sales. They didn't even mention McInnes once in their 108 pages of stock exchange releases today. And they were just going on, and the women of Australia have not stopped shopping at David Jones. Where are the feminists who are, with their consumer power, punishing this company, this blokey board, for letting this man run amok for far too many years? Now, I sort of see these examples quite a bit at public company AGMs. I remember being at the QBE insurance annual meeting in 2008, and John Cloney got up and said, the chairman said, "This is history. This is the first time ever that three women have been elected to a public company board on the one day." And then when it came for their actual elections, I got up and said, "Would you mind if we heard from the women, Mr. Chairman?" And he said, "No, that wouldn't be appropriate. We're not going to hear from the women." So I want to regale you with the stats, because QBE is actually one of the better companies having three women on the board. There's only three ASX 200 companies that have three women on the board: Perpetual, QBE Insurance and Westpac. Pacific Brands, Australia's biggest bra manufacturer, has five, so they're the only company with five. And then you fall back, you've got 35 top 200 companies with two, 67 top 200 companies with one, and 95 ASX 200 companies with zero. And I'm just going to present the other side with a full printout of those 95 companies.
Why, thank you. Wendy will be speaking to that very point, Stephen.
Okay, very good. So some of the big names: Asciano, Leighton Holdings, Cochlear, Flight Centre, Transfield, Transit. It's not just small mining companies. You've got some of the biggest companies in Australia that have absolutely no women on the board. It pervades all corners. It's not just in the public company space. And even when you do get a successful woman on a board, they often abandon the sisterhood. A really good example is someone like Elizabeth Alexander, who was appointed to the CSL board in 1991. CSL is our only successful international pharmaceutical company. Gardasil, cervical cancer, blood products, all that sort of stuff. She was the only female right through from 1991 until 2006. Then she was appointed chairman, and still, 4 years after being appointed chair, when she's the gatekeeper, There's still only one woman on the board. There's only ever been one woman on that board, and there's nine other blokes on the board. And that then pervades the management culture. You have a look at the top 10 managers at CSL, nine blokes and the usual one woman running HR. You always see that, the woman running HR. That's the one job they give them. I'd like to briefly talk about the media as well. Three of those companies of the 95 are media companies with no women on the board: APN News and Media, Austar, and Southern Cross Media. I'm an old News Corp newspaper reporter, and I remember going to the News Corp AGM in 1999. And at the time, there were press reports in the paper saying that the London Sun, the biggest selling tabloid in the world, might be getting rid of their page three girls. Now, I knew that the page three girls and London Sun had thrown off billions of dollars of money for News Corp shareholders and financed Rupert's takeover of the world. So I got up in 1999 and I said, Rupert, I've read the reports in the UK that you're looking at getting rid of the page three girls. I'm a bit worried this is going to hurt the cash flows. What are you going to do? And he said, well, in all seriousness, look, you know, society's, you know, standards and things move along and we might have to make some changes. But then he joked, but if it hurts the cash flow, we'll bring them right back. And would you believe it? 11 years later, every day, the London Sun, a page three girl, a topless woman standing there in the biggest selling tabloid in the world in a supposedly sophisticated democracy like the UK. You feminists, if you can't knock off page three girls in Britain, you have absolutely failed. I can tell you that much. Okay, and then what about newspaper editors? You've had Michelle Grattan had a stint on the Canberra Times. Gay Elkhorn, they give it one day a week on the Sunday Age. Jenny Cooper, one day a week on the Sunday Telegraph. There's never been a female editor of a major mainstream Australian daily mass market newspaper. News Corp, I'm going to see Rupert next month in New York for the AGM. 14 blokes and one 29-year-old opera singer, who's the only female on the board, who is the token representative of the Bancroft family, and he selected her because he knew that she would not have an impact, and she lives in Europe and he runs the company from New York. So these are the sorts of disgraceful situations that you still see in 2010. And I ask you a couple of other questions. Have you ever heard of the expression, the faceless women? They're always machine men and faceless men. At the end of the day, the people divvying up the power, the headhunters, the factional bosses, the corporate bosses who run the money are the blokes. And at the end of the day, if this country also got within this far of appointing Tony Abbott Prime Minister, that in itself is a massive failure of feminism.
Stephen, has feminism failed? So let's take a quick look at the history of that question. 1967, the eve of the second wave of feminism, and the Bulletin magazine publishes an article insisting that the feminist flag was being flown with futility and that feminism was unpopular. And let's cut to 1976, and Harper's magazine publishes a cover story with the headline, Requiem for the Women's Movement. Now, if those editors had only looked out the window, they might have noticed it wasn't a funeral procession going past. It was actually the biggest feminist-led upheaval since the suffragettes. Then in 1998, it was Time magazine's turn to ask, is feminism dead? And just in case you didn't think it was, the cover featured a picture of the skeletal Ally McBeal, as if to say a television character in desperate need of a feed was the appropriate barometer for the state of feminism. In the last 10 years, we've become used to such gloom and doom announcements. You know, feminism has let women down everywhere. It's been unsuccessful in delivering on its promises, and that the hoped-for feminist utopia just hasn't materialised. And of course it's true, women everywhere do still face problems. Some of them are enormous and daunting. But is this a sign of feminism's failure? Or simply of how much work there is that still needs to be done? No feminist that I've ever met thinks that feminism has succeeded in the sense that it is a completed program with its work done and its goals achieved. Indeed, I personally think that the feminist revolution is only just getting started. There is no quick fix.
There is no simple solution to all the problems that women face. Let me give you an example. I recently came across a 19th century discussion of so-called conjugal rights. A man's legal right to have sex with his wife, rape her in effect, whenever he wanted. Now, for the first wave feminists in Australia, those active in the late 19th and early 20th century, the abolition of conjugal rights was an extremely important goal. Yet it took a century, for rape in marriage to be outlawed in this country. It was 1985, in fact, in this state. Now, should we see these early feminists and their ideals as failures because it took a long time to achieve this goal? Or should we see them as heroic women whose fight would be continued by other women and whose aims would ultimately be achieved? Saying that feminism has failed is short-sighted and it's simplistic because it misunderstands and it underestimates both feminism and the problem that feminism is seeking to solve. Now, after all, who are these feminists who are said to have failed? And we've all usually got that archetype of feminist in mind. You know, oftentimes she's from the second wave of feminism. She's the activist who marched with Women's Lib in the 70s. She became a femocrat in the 80s, and ever since she's been hammering away at that glass ceiling. And the feminists who fit that description did incredible work, and they helped secure many of the fundamental reforms that we all take for granted today. But still, they only represent one strand of feminism and one approach. Feminism has always been complex, it's diverse, and yes, divided. And these days, many of us talk about feminisms, plural, rather than feminism. Real feminism is constantly evolving and splintering. It's broad, it's dynamic. Feminism attempts to articulate and redress injustices against women in a dazzling variety of contexts. We don't have a Bible. It's not a cult. And there never was a feminist central command with Germaine Greer at the head of the coven declaring that by the year 2010 a specific set of demands must be met or the game's off. Yet reducing feminism to this simplistic stereotype than declaring it a failure is far easier, more entertaining, and it's probably more satisfying than grappling with that nuance. It makes a better headline for a Sunday magazine supplement. It just happens to be completely wrong. It doesn't even make sense to declare something as complex as feminism as having failed. Talk about shooting the messenger. Yes, some feminists have failed in achieving their goals, and others manifestly have not. Yet feminism will continue, even if there are occasional setbacks and failures. And it will continue, whatever we may think or say tonight. Because at the heart of all feminist activity is a simple desire to create a better and a more just world for women. Indeed, merely declaring yourself a feminist is an act of hope. It's a recognition that women's lives can be improved and that we don't want to be the doormats of humanity. And saying that feminism has failed is a way of surrendering that hope. Now, this doesn't mean we should never be critical of feminist ideas. It's not a love-in. Disagreement among feminists is a sign of health, not of failure. And the very fact that we are able to define and discuss the many complex problems that women still face is due to feminism. That words like sexual harassment, domestic violence, sexism, words which we now take for granted, have now entered the vernacular. Feminism has given us a language to talk about these issues. And in doing this, in putting them on the public agenda, feminism has succeeded, even if women's problems have not all been solved. So what of the future? Feminism is only as powerful as its constituents, and we hear again and again and again that young women don't want to be feminists anymore, that women just aren't interested in the bigger problems. Well, if that's true, then I've been hallucinating, because from what I see, feminists are everywhere. And I don't get out much because I've got two small kids. And yet I see feminists organising. I see them discussing and lobbying. There are feminist salons. There are feminist conferences. There's been a resurgence in books about feminist issues and women reading them. Feminist voices are highly vocal in broader social justice groups, in mainstream political parties, and in their youth organisations. And internationally, Momentum is growing. For example, with movements which tackle sex trafficking and gender-based violence. I'm sure many of you have heard of the Half the Sky movement. Everyone is talking about this at the moment. There is debate, there is dialogue outside of our own backyards. And if you don't believe all this, get online and take a look. Feminists are all over the internet, from blogs to online campaigns. Now, to me, this groundswell of activity does not equate with failure. It looks more like a renaissance. One thing I know for certain, feminism has not failed me. It's allowed me to have a career, it's given me financial independence, it's encouraged me to take control of my reproduction, to value my body as my own, to see my worth as more than what I can do in bed and what my womb can do. It's given me a sense of unity with other women, it's opened my eyes to many injustices that I do not suffer, but that other women do. It has inspired me, infuriated, challenged me. It has not failed me. But this is not the point. Feminism is not about me, or more correctly, what it has done for me. Feminism is about a more just and equitable world for women, all women in their many and varied contexts. And as long as we keep saying this, as I know my feminist sisters do, we have not failed. We've only just begun.
The writer Monica Ducks on why she reckons feminism has definitely not failed, and she was speaking there at the recent Intelligence Squared debate at the Melbourne Town Hall. Remember, if your blood's boiling at what you're hearing, go to the website and leave a comment, or call the listener line and leave a message there. The number again is 02 833 1430. So now to the final two speakers in the debate asking, has feminism failed? For the affirmative is Gay Alcorn, the editor of the Sunday Age newspaper. She'll be followed by educator, advocate, mentor and businesswoman Wendy McCarthy. There are some compelling moments coming up. Over now to Gay Alcorn.
Gay Alcorn. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. A few years ago, I swapped over from being a reporter to being an editor, and I started to go to the news conference at The Age. It's a powerful body. We decide what goes in the paper and where it's going to go. I was startled at first by the language of news conference. Stories were categorised in two ways. There was what we call the hard cock stories. They were the good stories. We liked them. They were the penetrating stories. And then over there were the soft cock stories. We didn't like them. They were a bit girly, and they weren't going to get in the paper. Now, I was taken aback by this at first, but after a short time, I didn't notice the language anymore. And it wasn't much long after that when I was ordering up good hard cock stories as much as I could. What I'm saying there really is that the language became entirely normal. It wasn't noticed anymore. And it made absolutely no difference whether there were women in the room or there weren't women in the room. So if feminism was only about individual women getting ahead, Jennifer, Monica, myself, then we'd concede this debate. We'd say, yes, you've won, if that's all it was about. There are more women politicians, there are more women journalists, there are more women pilots and engineers. But in our view, feminism was far more, always far more ambitious than just that. Germaine Greer wrote recently that the reason she wrote The Female Eunuch 40 years ago now was that she wanted to work out why giving women the vote, a huge thing, had made, and what she said, it had made very little difference to the masculine power structure. That's what feminism was supposed to do. 40 years on, a lot's happened, a lot of good things have happened. Equal opportunity laws, sex discrimination laws, equal pay for equal work, on paper at least. But again, we'd argue that it has still made very little difference to the masculine power structure. Has it achieved, and we'd argue it hasn't, has it achieved real change in the powerful institutions that actually make the decisions about what we'll talk about, frame the debates about what we talk about, or it hasn't? Has the real culture that our boys and girls grow up in, has that changed substantially? Now, culturally, I'd have to take issue with Jennifer, who said, look, our feminism has been so successful, we barely notice it. I'd argue that in Australia, sexism is so embedded, we barely notice it. most people have stopped fighting for it. I'll give you one example. Body image issues. Big issues, young women in particular, young girls. So what do? We set up a national advisory committee on body image, a very feminist way to do things. And Kate Ellis, the gorgeous Kate Ellis, and Sarah Murdoch, ex-model, and the beautiful Mia Friedman launched the campaign on body image. And you don't have to be in the media to know that the reason they did that was obvious, because it would get no publicity if they had plain, ugly, fat women launching a committee on body image. Defeated almost before the campaign is launched. Marie Claire, terribly worried about the unrealistic images of women in magazines. What do? They put Jen Hawkins nude on the cover of Marie Claire to launch a campaign about better representations of women. You can say, that's just pop culture. But we'd argue that it is actually the culture, and feminism has very little influence on that anymore. Greer, when she wrote, she said that, look, she looked at why voting didn't have much influence on the power structure, and she said, look, feminism is supposed to be about freedom. And the women at that time, 40 years ago, mostly women housewives she was talking about, they weren't free for a number of reasons. And I reckon they're equally valid today. They weren't free, and I'll run through a few of them, because there was an endless struggle with conflicting demands of others. As workers, carer, mother, sex object, women were alienated from their own sexual desires, and women were exploited by a beauty industry that makes money out of female anxiety. So 40 years on, where are we? Is it less contradictory to be a young woman today? Is pole dancing empowering for me or not? The Age runs many stories on that topic. Do I want to be a slut today or not? I'm not sure. I want to have kids, but my career will disappear, and it will disappear. Is female sexuality any less defined by men now than it was 40 years ago? You'd have to say that's worse, because now young men have been brought up with an idea of sexuality, or female sexuality, that's based on pornography. Is the beauty industry exploiting women any less than it did? You'd have to say, not really, because no longer do women have to be young and beautiful when they are young, but they have to be young and beautiful when they are old. I was disturbed recently to see a photograph on the cover of Good Weekend of Blanche DePouget, who'd written a book on Bob Hawke, and she's a woman in her 60s, and she looked embalmed. Feminism has no answer to any of it. They form committees, they're academics writing books, they have forums like this. But real women say, particularly young women say, well, this is the real world I'm living in. I have to make sense of the contradictions of being a woman in this kind of culture. And what you say is not helping me deal with it anymore. In terms of power, feminism tried hard, but fail to really change the way power operates in a country like Australia. It matters because it's those institutions that make the decisions, the real decisions about what we do, and they actually get to frame the debate, not just contribute to the debate. Stevens talked about the upper echelons of business, but it's the same wherever you look. In law, yes, 60% of graduates are female, 3% of managing partners are female. But again, statistics aren't the only thing when we talk about this. It's what those institutions actually do and how they're structured. The most obvious example, and I'll talk about this one quickly, it's been well researched, is the world of work. The world of work hasn't changed dramatically, been extremely slow to change. For business, the perfect worker remains a workaholic. The hours worked by full-time workers in Australia are increasing. It's about 50 hours a week for a quarter of workers now. And, of course, the most stressed workers, according to the research, are female part-time workers. I'm a female editor of a newspaper. My sports editor is a female. The coverage of female sport in the Australian media is about 9%, and never much budges. What have we done about that? We've had a couple of conversations in the corridors, but essentially we've done very little. And the reason given, if you're in a position, even authority even, is that people don't want to read about female sport. There is actually some research that they do want to read more about female sport, but that tends to be dismissed as, well, they say that but they don't really mean it. But I think I really knew that feminism had failed, and I say it with no joy. I am a feminist, but my daughter, 18-year-old, is not a feminist. But I think I really knew that it had failed in my heart when I read about J.K. Rowling, a female author, obviously, of the most successful books of our generation, the Harry Potter books. But she's not called Joanne Rowling, and have you ever wondered why that is? The publisher of her books was so nervous about putting a female name on the cover because they did not believe that the parents of boys would buy a book with a female name on it. Of course, girls, parents of girls do. They don't mind reading a book by a male, but somehow that wasn't going to sell to boys. That's the real world we live in. And feminism, unfortunately, has made hardly a dent in it. Thank you.
Well, it seems that some of us live on different planets. Stephen Mayne thinks that feminism is about women on boards. God help me. Although I will recognise, I will register that there are 6,000 women registered to be on women on boards. Virginia has seemingly forgotten that no woman read the news on ABC until 1982 because their voices weren't authoritative. She's lucky she's got the job. And Gay's in a position to make changes. I want to say to you today that feminism has been one of the powerful social movements of the last 40 years. As a working grandmother, I'm glad I've got that title, I can see enormous changes during that time. Before feminism, as women, we had no voice. We certainly weren't on the front pages of the magazine until we started to act up and out. That got us there very smartly. And if one of the great successes of feminism, which I noticed that the other side did not mention, is the education of women. And education is still the main game in every country in the world. And in this country, 55% of graduates are female. When I went to university, less than 20% of the intake was female. My university scholarship, I had to score more marks than a male because it was thought that they would stay longer. On the other hand, when I got married after 3 years, my bond was waived because marriage was a suitable career for a woman. But I couldn't go back to teaching. When my friends got married in the Commonwealth public sector, they both had jobs on Friday. On Monday, he did and she didn't. And that was the case until 1966, and as far as we know, the only thing that happened in the weekend to change their suitability was that they had sex with each other. They may have had before, but at least we know it was legitimate. In 1960s, abortion was almost inaccessible and women died. In my own experience, to get an abortion required 30 phone calls, 63 guineas, large amount of money, cops patrolling up and down the road, hoping that someone would give you some advice when you left. They didn't give you contraception. If you were lucky, you got a pill, Panadol equivalent, probably Bex, and ask you to have a good lie down, but not with the bloke. And that was it. Contraception was the privilege of doctors. When I went to my first doctor to get contraception, he said, I can't give you a script until you're married. It was 1964, and I said, I'm getting married in 3 months, and he said, well, I'll date it the day of your wedding. It's 50 years this year since the pill was available, but it was not available to unmarried women, and when you did buy it, it was classified as a luxury tax, the same as a cosmetic, and it was very expensive and not available to all. And it was one of Gough Whitlam's first things to take the luxury tax off the contraception. Family planning clinics didn't see unmarried women easily. Childbirth was also a doctor's choice. This is what feminism was about. It's the sum total of the parts of women supporting each other and taking up challenges to change things for the better for all of us. In work, we had jobs, not careers. And there were legal impediments, like the marriage bars. My story, one of my friend's mothers was a pharmacist. She married a bank manager. You can put this in your file, Stephen. now the ANZ, then the ESNA. And when they went to a town in Queensland, she said, well, now that we're married, I'm going to get a job and a pharmacist here. I'll probably buy one. And the bank said, no, you can't work. Because what would everyone say? They would say, well, we were not paying the bank manager enough money to support his wife. 6 weeks ago, she got her first paycheck. She said, I'll never bank it. I'll just put it there to remind me of how hard it's been. Feminism's worked for her. It might have taken a long time, but it's worked. Equal pay. The unions didn't support equal pay. Corporations didn't support equal pay. It was women who went to get equal pay. And I'm not pretending that we have it. But we have more rights about how to negotiate it than we ever had. No maternity leave existed. When I was teaching, as soon as I announced my pregnancy, they said, right, take you off those classes because you won't be coming back. If I came back, it was as a casual worker. And then, of course, the ultimate cultural assumption. My favourite response to the Women's Electoral Lobby Survey in 1972, which polled every member, every candidate for Parliament. And Sir John Cramer, then the member for Bennelong, in response to what is a woman's greatest attribute, said, I think the test for all women, the greatest attribute they can have, is virginity. This is 1972. Now, for those of us who'd lost it, we wondered what our residual value could possibly be. Not politics. My argument is that change didn't just happen, and guys, it doesn't just happen. You have to do it. It's not inevitable. Inevitability has never worked for social movements. You have to get on with it. Childcare. Still one of the big unanswered ones, because the cultural assumptions around the value of children haven't changed. On the other hand, I am increasingly seeing that feminism has created spaces for men to be better parents and to enjoy their children and have much more equal relationships. It was one of the dreams of the feminist movement. Discrimination legislation is enabling. Changes in divorce law. No-fault divorce in 1975. More women in Parliament was one of the early ones. And so for the 70s, that decade of consciousness raising, we forced Australian politics to respond, political parties, and they did. Business and public sector were slower to act, but in the 80s, a lot of things were fixed up. And what do contemporary feminists dream of? We dream of leadership now. We want to write the legislation. So we need to be in Parliament. And we're on our way. And has nobody on the other side noticed we have a female Prime Minister, a female Premier, a few female governors and Governor-General? We are suddenly finding a difference. We want to be leaders in spirituality and religion. We want to create wealth and write the cheques. We want to demonstrate there are better ways to run business that are more child-friendly. And we want to stop a woman dying every 2 minutes in childbirth and make sure that girls go to school. Feminism has been enabling for women. It's encouraged risk-taking, and it's helped diminish what Simone de Beauvoir described as the concept of women as the other. What more could we ask other than it continues for all, but you have to be engaged. And as a sign of success, surely, last week I read in The Guardian that the number of obituaries for significant women is growing. Surely a sign that we're noticed in our dying. Thank you.
Splendid Wendy McCarthy with the final word from the Melbourne Intelligence Squared debate, Has Feminism Failed? When the votes came in, almost 54% of those attending were against the motion, which was subsequently lost. I'd love to know what you think, though, so please get in touch in the usual way. That's at abc.net.au/rn/lifematters. That's the website. You can find us on Facebook very easily. If you're on Facebook, you'll find that we are too. And, of course, the number is 02 833 1430. On Monday's Life Matters, Western Australia is about to become the first state to apologise to women, children and families affected by its past adoption practices, and we'll hear from some of those affected. We'll also meet, a young writer, Steph Bow. She's only 16. The Book Show is coming up next with Anita Barrow, and today it's a conversation about faith, language and history. I'm Richard Aidy. The news is next. Have a good weekend.
The City of London has always been very innovative.
Long before Wall Street became the symbol of international global finance, there was the City in London.
So it's always moving in new fields and new markets. And some of the new ways of doing business with derivatives and the futures exchange, some of that creativity has found its way into the City at this period.
That's Rear Vision, and you can download or stream this program from the Radio National website.